I said, find yourself some nice big deal. Someone who says he likes you before he says he loves you. Come back with Chips Rafferty, I said. And what do? You come back with Victor fucking Mature.
Fuck me, dear.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 38. This time around, I'm doing Deep in the Heart of Ausploitation. The documentary on Ausploitation films, Not Quite Hollywood, has been released on DVD in the US. If you're in that part of the planet, buy a copy, rent a copy, put it on Netflix, whatever you need to do. But see that film. A lot of the stuff in that film is stuff that I'm going to reference this podcast, and it will be helpful if you can get a copy of it. If you can't, that's fantastic too, because I'm going to try to explain what ausploitation is, where it came from, where it is in the 21st century, and in general, just look at the whole genre and make a few recommendations on the good stuff. This is Terry Frost, by the way, and I'll let Sal do the intro with all of the contact details for the podcast. We'll do some letters, and yes, I did get correspondence this time, and I did copy it. Did keep it, and I will go through it with you guys. Okay, on with the intro and then into the podcast.
Paleo Cinema is a 3-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Okay, on to the letters. And oddly enough, the first one I got was from Sally herself. She decided she was going to send me an email about the last podcast. So I'll just read it now. Dear Terry, upon listening to your latest podcast, number 37, I was most disappointed about the amount of sex and rudeness mentioned. The parts with the supposed stand-up comedy of Rudy Ray Moore were absolutely disgusting, and a laugh did not pass my lips the entire time. As for the scene in the boat that rocked, of which you referred rather excitedly about, I have to say this, get over it. It was only boobs for Darwin's sake. Congrats on your second anniversary. You've done a great job and definitely improved over the 2 years. Keep up the great work, and may you have many more years to come. Love, Sal. Thank you for that, Sal. It's a bit nepotistic to read out an email from my wife, but if I didn't, I would have been in deeper shit than if I did. So anyway, that's it for Sal's one. Let's have a look. I've got a couple of things on Twitter, which is quite fun too. I got a tweet from Rob Freelander who said, just stumbled on your podcast recently and liked it a lot. Tracked down Sands of the Kalahari after listening today. Yeah, Sands of the Kalahari's come out on DVD since I did the podcast about that. Definitely recommend that film. Two-fisted, blokey adventure film. So I'm glad that I gave you a recommendation, Bob, that you can take up and enjoy. So terrific stuff there. Next one. Got one from a guy called Ray who says, hi, Terry, love the podcast. I've been looking for a movie titled The Secret of My Success from 1965, starring Stella Stevens, Shirley Jones and Honor Blackman. Do you know anything about this film? Thanks, Ray. Yeah, Ray, I do know something about this film. In fact, I saw it first in the 1960s. So what do I know about The Secret of My Success, which is not to be confused with the Michael J. Fox movie of the same name from 1987? I watched it this year on TCM. That's one of the Tender Classic Movies channels. It's one of the channels I get on my cable subscription. And I first saw it at the Regal Theatre in Liverpool when I was a kid in the late 1960s. When I first saw the film, I thought it was incredibly cool because Honor Blackman lived in a castle and bred giant spiders. And when I say giant spiders, I mean Shetland pony-sized spiders, not just large spiders. The movie stars James Booth, an actor who was a close friend of Rod Taylor's, and that fucked me dead at the start of the podcast was Rod Taylor from Welcome to Whoop Whoop. He appeared in at least two of Rod Taylor's movies, The Man Who Had Power Over Women and Darker Than Amber. The movie is also known by a longer title. The Secret of My Success, or How Three Beautiful Girls Love for Fun and Murder for Profit. Booth played a country copper whose mother, played by Amy Dalby, manipulates and blackmails wealthy criminals to advance his career, and ultimately he ends up being quite wealthy and things like that. James Booth wasn't an actor who particularly did comedy well, but the film does have a few redeeming features. Of course, Honor Blackman's in it, so that was a good one as well. And Lionel Jeffries plays four different roles, and he was doing one of those Peter Sellers types things where Peter Sellers would play four or five different characters, Dr. Strangelove being the most obvious one of those. But Lionel Jeffries does quite well playing four very different characters in the film. It's a very minor film from the 60s. I've been trying to track down whether it's available apart from on cable, and I don't believe that it is on DVD or by any other download means. Unfortunately, because it's got the same title as a more recent film, it tends to be overshadowed by that film. So any references you look up to The Secret of My Success, even if you put in the date and things into the search engines, it tends to bring up the more recent films. So I'll keep my eyes open and I'll announce in the podcast if I find anything else about that, Ray. But good luck looking for it. It is a minorly interesting film. Some people will probably like it more than I did, but it wasn't too bad and it wasn't entirely a waste of time when I watched it. Unfortunately, I didn't record it. Anyway, next announcement. I did get an email from Weaverman, who I haven't heard from for a while, and I understand the reasons why. He says, "Hi, Terry. After finishing listening to the latest podcast, just finished listening to the latest podcast. Thought-provoking and entertaining as usual. I expect nothing less. Congratulations on the second anniversary. October 24th is the second anniversary of this incarnation of Flea Pit, which is his website. I'll put a link up to it on the thing. So I'll have to come up with something big. As you know, the last couple of years have been difficult for me as my Terry's illness got worse and her death last April really knocked me out. Blogging and reading other blogs, particularly yours and SERP's, kept me sane. Since April, my life has seemed to have reshaped itself and settling back into my flat, which I vacated to care for Terry, has been difficult, but I'm getting there. I know you've had some bad times yourself, and I hope you're feeling better these days. Make sure you see the Swedish vampire movie, Let the Right One In. I really can't recommend it enough. Take care, my friend. Best wishes to your lady, Weaverman." Thanks for that, Weaverman. And the same back to you. I hope your life is settling in, and I know it was incredibly difficult and traumatic for you, and our thoughts are with you. I've seen the Let the Right One In. I saw it about 6 months ago, and a very good dubbed version of it. And, really great vampire movie. It takes a totally different spin on vampires. See the original. There is going to be an American remake called Let Me In or something like that. As usual with Paleo Cinema, go to the original source. Don't wait for it to get remade by people who perhaps have less imagination and talent than the people who made the original. Yeah, I totally agree with that summation of the film. It is quite a memorable movie and done extremely well. One of the things I love about doing Paleo Cinema is hearing from people in exotic locations. Obviously to the people themselves, the locations are less exotic than they are to me. But I got our first email from a Paleo Cinema listener in Indonesia. And Indonesia being one of the closest countries to Australia. I like it. Okay, the guy's name is Andrew Rensalendu, and I hope I pronounced that right, Andrew. He says, "Hello, Terry. Just wanted to drop you a line that I really enjoy your podcast. I found it by accident, being a movie buff. I started to look around the net for podcasts devoted to esoteric movies, and I found Paleo Cinema and have been a regular listener ever since. Thanks to you, I've reassessed some movies that I've dismissed beforehand and also found some little-known gems. I've been on a musical kick lately, and as a suggestion, maybe you can devote an episode to Lerner and Lowe or Rodgers and Hammerstein. Indonesia's film industry has for the last decade risen from a decade-old slump in which the only movies being produced are cheapy sex films. But since the beginning of this decade, many talented young filmmakers have come to the spotlight with influences ranging from Michael Bay to Stanley Kubrick. What surprises me is that some movies from Indonesia from the late 70s and early 80s are now being touted as trash classics by certain movie buffs. Well, just wanted to say thank you for the podcast. I really like it. Keep up the good work." Thank you, Andrew. And it's great hearing from people from a somewhat different culture than my own. And, I have heard a little bit about Indonesia's movie renaissance. And all power to you. I hope it goes well. It is a little hard to get the movies here in Australia, which is ridiculous given how close by you guys are and how many Australians would be available to translate into English from Bahasa Indonesian or whichever language the majority of films are. And I'm sorry that I don't know more about that. I am going to research it. I'm glad you enjoy the podcast too. As far as musicals are concerned, can I devote an episode to Lionel Mel, Rodgers and Hammerstein? I may devote one to musicals in general from the 50s, particularly Hollywood stuff at some stage. There are some interesting ones that are maybe a little off the mainstream. I think I always preferred Rodgers and Hart to Rodgers and Hammerstein, though linking back into today's podcast, one of the things, the audio I did at the start of the podcast was from a movie called Welcome to Whoop Whoop. And the kind of outback community where it takes place, everybody plays Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. The whole community sits down and watches The Sound of Music and other Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, and Rodgers and Hammerstein songs are playing over the PA systems in the town all the time. So it was really funny. I was ripping the audio for the podcast and got the email roughly at the same time. So while I'm listening to audio about Rodgers and Hammerstein, I get your email about it. If you can get a copy of Welcome to Whoop Whoop, it is a weird modern Ausploitation movie. Maybe a little hard to get in some places, but if you can find a torrent or something like that, check it out. So thank you very much for that, Andrew. Keep sending emails. Any feedback, any suggestions, I'll look at them and see how we go with it. And I'm glad that you're enjoying the podcast and it is getting you to reassess some films. I don't expect everybody to agree with me. In fact, I'd probably be really pissed off if everybody did. But, it's all about just sharing what you like and seeing how it goes. So that's about it for the emails and tweets and other things like that. Thanks for the feedback. Again, it's kultguru@gmail.com. Terry Frost or Paleo Cinema without the dash on Twitter. And the website's where the website usually is. So I'm going to get into Ausploitation. I'll just do a little bit of a sound bite first, and then maybe talk about the history of Australian exploitation films right from the start.
Fuck me, Dick.
The erratic, scorching struggle for self-preservation, the frustrations, yearnings, and dreams of Jet Set City spring to life in The Set, a sensational film in which no attempts have been made to hide or even rationalize the permissiveness of the age in which we live.
Fuck me, Dick.
Okay, Ausploitation. Where did Ausploitation start? Now, I did my homework, as always, for the podcast, and looked in right back to the beginning of cinema. And now, exploitation movies are as old as cinema itself. Even when we didn't call them exploitation movies, there already existed the concept of films created purely as entertainment, which are designed to shock, amuse, titillate, and surprise an audience. Cinema started out as just another act in music halls and vaudeville venues. The highbrow movies came later. The little short films were shown along with music hall acts at the end of the 19th century. So Australia leapt on the exploitation bandwagon much later than other countries for reasons that were mostly political rather than economic or social. Australia has a history of cinema censorship that dates back to the very inception of the medium. The very first feature film made in Australia, The Story of the Killer Gang in 1906, was considered an exploitation movie at the time, in all but the name. The first showing of the movie was at Melbourne at the Athenaeum Hall on the 26th of December 1906. Many groups at the time, including some politicians and the police, interpreted the film as glorifying criminals. The Kelly Gang was Ned Kelly's gang. There was a 1960s movie starring Mick Jagger called Ned Kelly, and that'll tell you the story of it. In the towns of Benalla and Wangaratta, the film was banned in 1907, of course. The initial showing was in December 1906, so most people saw it in 1907. And in 1912, it was banned in all of Victoria. The film toured Australia for over 20 years and was also shown in New Zealand and Britain. The backers and exhibitors made a fortune from it, but here's the bit that gets me from Paleo Cinema's point of view. In 2007, The Story of the Kelly Gang was inscribed in the UNESCO Memory of the World Register for being the world's first full-length feature film. So there's an argument for stating that the very first feature film in the world was an exploitation movie of sorts, The Story of the Kelly Gang. So moving along from there, the censorship in Australia was the worst censorship in any Western country. It was incredibly draconian and, really, being honest about it, fairly stupid. I read you out a few things that were banned from movies from the early years of Australia in the cinema, and just show you how silly it was. Jazz films depicting alleged goings-on of modern youth were banned. Sentimentality or sob stuff was an insidious influence. Australian censorship was in favour of outright rejection rather than having to doctor a radically bad film. This is from 1925. In 1926, the censors decided that honeymoon scenes would be eliminated. Objection was made to passing Beau Geste due to a misunderstanding. First censored sound films were screened on Christmas Eve 1928 because they were unhappy with the fact that they'd have to actually censor words as well as the images and the script cards that came up. So the censors regretted the advent of sound. The soul of the film was its eloquent and vital silence, and the old mystery and beauty are given away more and more to the depiction of the sordid and the vulgar, with tiresome emphasis on incidents drawn from stage life. And sound is hastening the Americanization, especially in regards to the speech of the Australian people. The first British talkie blackmail was rejected, a tendency on the part of British producers to copy a type of incident in which the hero and heroine spent the night together, sometimes only after a few hours of acquaintance, made the film bannable. In the 1930s, there were orders from the censors about things like the smartness and sophistication stepping over the borderline into suggestiveness and indecency was to be forbidden. British films in 1932, they were complaining about those too. Too many bath scenes and too much bedroom farce. Prominent English actors splashing in their tubs and spitting essential dialogue through their teeth. An effort to flood the Australian market with a certain type of propaganda picture, e.g. chain gangs, gangsters, civil and political graft, and abuses of various kinds should be forbidden. Why should dirty American linen be washed in the presence of an Australian audience? Protest is made against the undesirable emphasis upon immoral sexual relations, e.g. the mistress theme, and some Australian films, much vaunted for their Australian atmosphere, make other people wonder if outback settlers are ultra-simple-minded and mentally childish. It's just, looking back on it, you're amazed at the pettiness of these people. And they say the fanaticism is redoubling your efforts when you've forgotten your goal. And reading through the extracts from all the censorship stuff in the 1930s and 40s and even 50s, it just shows how ludicrous censorship is with adults. I mean, of course, there's always going to be banning of certain kinds of material which are coercive and where the participants in a movie aren't able to offer explicit consent and informed consent for what goes on in the films. Child pornography, of course, and certain scenes of real sexual violence and those sort of things, and murders and real-life murders and all those sort of things. But I'm amazed at how petty these people were and how they were protecting the country from things which are, to our 21st century viewpoint, incredibly innocuous. We live with this stuff since the beginning of films, so basically from, say, 1906, well into the 1970s. So 1971 is when the R certificate came in. And it was crazy, the stuff they banned. Frankenstein and Dracula weren't able to be seen in Australia. Chunks of Forbidden Planet were censored because they were thought to be too scary for the audience. And I'll give you the best examples from kind of later in the 1950s and 1960s. Now, before the government created the R certificate for movies in 1971, a stunning number of movies were banned in Australia. Fellini's The Miracle, La Dolce Vita, and Satyricon. Louis Buñuel's Viridiana, Ingmar Bergman's The Silence, Antonioni's Blow Up, and Zabriskie Point were all forbidden. Movie buffs had to travel overseas to see any of these films. So, you know, you want to see La Dolce Vita, of course, you know, classic Fellini movie. You have to travel to Europe to see it. It was totally nuts. So one of the arguments for the creation of the R certificate was to have a way for making the films of people like Fellini and Antonioni and Bergman and Buñuel and other, you know, people we consider classic film directors accessible to Australian audiences without corrupting our children or people who didn't want to see confronting a challenging material. The reality when the R certificate came in was very different. In Sydney at the time, there were only a few art house cinemas in the eastern suburbs where the posh people lived. The big money wasn't in the art house quality films that were suddenly available. It was rolling out of the drive-ins and the flea pits in the suburbs when the R rating came in, with movies like Bedroom Berserker and The Language of Love, and one I remember, Dagmar's Hot Pants, and an American movie cut for R rating called The Case of the Smiling Stiffs. I mean, there were biking movies like The Born Losers and The Losers and Easy Rider. Overseas exploitation movies proved incredibly popular. When I was a kid, the drive-ins and the hardtops in the burbs were full of movies about tits and bikers and pseudo-documentaries about sexuality, which they wouldn't let me in to see. I did manage to sneak in. I started sneaking in at about the age of 15, which would have made it, do the numbers, about 1972. They really didn't give a shit in the local cinema how old you were, as long as you could pay for a ticket. So I just snuck in at 15 when I was supposed to be 18 to see these movies. The gist of it is that the lowbrow entertainment was where the money was. When Australian filmmakers became inspired by the exploitation movies from overseas that were really raking in the dollars and started making kick-ass entertainment flicks, the phenomenon Mark Hartley, much later called Ozploitation, was born. So what I'm going to do with the rest of the podcast is do a sampler of Ozploitation movies. First one is probably The Naked Bunyip. It was in 1970, and it was one of the films that really stuck the nails in the coffin of pre R-rating censorship in Australia. Now, this title, directed by John B. Murray and produced by Philip Adams, was had problems in 1970.
It's about Australian attitudes to sex and censorship. It's The Naked Bunyip. What do you think about the degree of permissiveness in film and theatre, of sex in advertising, the pup scene, abortion, contraception, homosexuality, prostitution? Does sex mean love? Is the subject still taboo? The Naked Bunyip is a searching and tolerant survey of all aspects of sex in modern society.
But at the moment, I'm working as a female impersonator and I love doing it.
Graham Blundell, as the game market researcher, faces a challenge just a little too big for him. He saw sex as Australia sees it, in the spotlights of The Pink Pussycat, Atlee Girl, in Sequins and Feathers. He talks with a madam of a brothel, with fashion models, photographers, the guy in the street, with Ray Taylor, Dr. Bertram Wainer, and many others. It's all told with a gentle sense of humour in The Naked Bunyip.
Okay, so they made The Naked Bunyip, and they took it to the censors, and the censors demanded that they slash the shit out of the film. There were large chunks of the images they wouldn't enable them to show in a commercial release. There were large chunks of dialogue they wanted to erase because it brought up things like abortions. There's an interview of someone who went through a backyard abortion, and there was an attempt to encourage legalization of abortion. So there were a lot of social reasons why this film was quite important at the time. It was openly looking at things that some people in authority perhaps didn't want them to look at. And at that stage too, abortion was still illegal in Australia. So they did have an agenda to push. So they got back the report from the censor saying, oh, this, and this had got to be cut. They did something very unusual and quite smart when they received that back. They decided what they would do is the offending images they would cover up with a cartoon of a bunyip, which is a mythical Australian Aboriginal creature. So they made up something that looked like a cartoon dragon almost, and covered up any offending images with that. And where the offensive dialogue was in the film, they played a siren's noise over the dialogue so people could not hear it. So in the end, they released the film. It was first shown at the Palais in St Kilda in 1970, and the whole point of the film became not talking about sexuality in an open and frank and way, the way the blurb you just heard announces, but it was a condemnation of censorship. They were saying, here's the film, and we're going to make, in the most blatant way possible, it very obvious to the audience which bits the censor won't let you hear and see. And of course, this encouraged the move to the R rating so that adult material could be viewed openly by adults. By mocking the censors, by covering up offending images and things like that in a ridiculous way, the people who made The Naked Bunyip encouraged the creation of a more and light and viewpoint. And I kind of like that. I like the fact that you don't let the bastards win. You make fun of them, and you make fun of them using their own tools against them. So that's one of the reasons why I like that film. And if you get the DVD, and it is available, you can have it bought from overseas if you do a bit of a web search on it. Then the interesting thing about the film is that the DVD release has as the main film the censored version, but the extra bits that were censored originally in 1970 are on the extra, so you can hear and see what offended the censor so much in 1970. It's quite a good release, and from an historical cinema point of view in Australia, it's quite an important one as well. It does show how far we've come in allowing adult human beings the right to see and hear things without a government intervening. So moving along from The Naked Bunyip, the R certificate came in, and the first big hit of the Ausploitation era was a movie that was made by Barry Humphries, who a lot of people know as Dame Edna Everidge, based on a comic strip that he and Nicholas Garland created for Private Eye magazine, the satirical magazine in England owned by Peter Cook. And it was The Adventures of Barry McKenzie, a story about a very gormless Australian lad who goes to England with his auntie to see the old country and has various adventures, and all the Poms are greedy bastards who never wash, and England is portrayed very much like a third world country in a lot of ways, in a very satirical kind of way. And it was incredibly popular as a cult film.
Listen, mate, I need to splash the boots. You know, strain the potatoes.
G'day, ladies and gentlemen. Barry McKenzie's the name.
He's got a great big grin and a great big chin. Give him half a chance, he'll be in like Flynn. His great big fist will flatten any palm. He's got a great big thirst, you can do your worst. When they touch the cave, he'll be in there first. It's no use, mate, you never win. He's a better man than you are, Gunga Din.
Raymond, this is Barry McKenzie.
Go and stick your head up a dead bear's bum.
Look, Barry, seriously, I've been promising myself a trip to the old country ever since Norm's little operation. My family came from Britain many moons ago, you know.
Hello, sir. I'm terribly sorry, but somebody must have let that Australian lunatic on the set.
If we can't make bread out of an authentic Australian folk singer, I'll quit this racket. Idiom.
Right, you chose well, sir. You chose well here. Hey, like it? That'd be 43 guineas for this sweep.
Capital idea. I'll take the boy into my den and put it up to him.
Oh, no, you won't, you filthy old perv. I'll ask him.
I want you to think of me as someone that you can turn toward.
Yeah, from what I've heard of your mob, you won't catch me turning any other way.
From the team that brought you Sir Robert Manzi.
Unbutton the mutton. You know, point Percy at the porcelain.
I think he wants to go to the loo.
So The Adventures of Barry McKenzie was xenophobic, it was homophobic. It took the piss out of both England and English culture and the attitude of Australians who go over to live in England for a while in the 1970s and basically mock everything they see. So there was a two-edged sword to the satire in this film. But the funny thing is that a lot of the audience in Australia, at least, didn't see the satire. They just saw someone making fun of the English without seeing the satirical aspects of themselves in the film. I know I didn't, but I was only like 14, 15 at the time. But I loved the fact that there was nudity in it. There was throwing up in it. There were punch-ups. There was lots of drinking of beer. It had everything that a teenage boy growing up in the suburbs of Sydney in the 1970s could want from a film, except there could have been more tits. But it was incredibly popular. It made a lot of money. It cost about $600,000 to make, and it made well over $1 million, so they definitely got their money back. And they later made a sequel, Barry McKenzie Holds His Own, where Bazza and his mates go up against a bunch of vampires in Transylvania, led by Donald Pleasence, playing Count Plasma. And one of the nice things about the films I like is the fact that it was both of them were directed by the guy who directed Driving Miss Daisy, Bruce Beresford, a now well-known and well-respected Australian filmmaker who unashamedly admits that he had a hell of a time making The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. He liked the film, and his commentary on it is quite good as well. So that really got the exploitation thing kicking into gear.
Hey, what's that, Four Eyes?
Oh, that's the immigration department, mate. Interviewing all the poor old poms who want to share our incomparable living standards and cultural attainments.
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test.
Right.
Three simple questions, three correct answers, and you go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you, sweetheart. All righty, Bob. Here we go. First question. Which country, I repeat, which country leads the world with regard to music, ballet, theatre, opera, poems, novels, paintings and films? You've got 10 seconds, Bob.
Australia.
Correct, absolutely correct. You've been doing your homework, haven't you? Very, very good. Are you ready for question number two?
Yes, yes.
Okay, Bob, here it comes.
Right.
Which particular country on the face of the earth has the biggest and best beaches, drive-in bottle shops, scenery, motels, marsupials, beer, table wines, high-rise development, and sheilas? 10 seconds from now, Bob.
Australia?
The correct answer! Oh, well done. Well done. Third question coming up, and this is the big one.
Yeah.
And the very, very best of good luck, Bob.
Thank you.
By the way, Bob, you married?
Well, no, not really.
Pufta?
Beg your pardon?
Section 24, subsection B3. No puftas allowed.
Oh, naturally.
Okay, Bob. Okay, this is it. This is the big one.
Right.
Third question coming up.
All right.
Which country is the asshole of the world? Bob, I don't know. You're right on the bell. I just don't know. I'll have to throw that over to the judges, Bob. I'm sorry. What do you think, judges?
Oh, what do you reckon? Is he pushed? Well, don't forget he's a pawn. You can't expect too much on that score.
He is. Yeah. No, please, I beg of you, for humanity's sake, let me walk tall in Australia.
Well, what do you say? Just take a chance. Yeah. Robert Crowther?
Yes.
Australia extends to you a fond greeting. Well done, Bob, mate. You're in.
But while Bazza was in England taking the piss out of the poms, and in the movie sometimes pissing on them, there was another Australian icon being born in the suburbs of Melbourne.
In full working order.
He is what's clinically known as a satyromaniac. That's the male equivalent of an infomaniac. He can't keep his hands off anyone.
Alvin Purple. Handsome. Charming. Artistic. From the very start, it was obvious here was a young man with a big future in front of him.
He'll get pregnant, you know.
And won't you be jealous?
Let go!
He was a popular student. Always on good terms with the staff.
Oh,
Mrs. Hallwood.
There are openings everywhere for the right man. Find out what you want to do, and then extend yourself.
He became a dedicated salesman.
In this world, there's no one who can afford to be slack.
In fact, he spent most of his time on the job.
I'm still afraid of the dark.
Big girl like you?
I'm only big on something.
Yep, Alvin Purple was a big hit too. It was very much played on the sex comedy aspect from the imported films that were very popular when the R rating first came out. In fact, it was so popular it generated two sequels, Alvin Purple Rides Again and Melvin, Son of Alvin in the 1980s. And just like the Planet of the Apes movies, each one got progressively worse. So Alvin Purple was incredibly popular. Now, there were any number, after that, there were any number of sexy movies made in Australia to capitalise on the popularity of Alvin Purple and those imported films. There was Plug, which was made in Perth, which was probably one of the worst movies I ever saw. The True Story of Eskimo Nell, which was set in the gold fields of the 1850s in Australia. There was a documentary called The Love Epidemic, which was about VD, and it was directed by Brian Trenchard-Smith, who later went on to make The Man from Hong Kong. And there was John Lemond's documentary Australia After Dark, and there was another one called The ABC of Love and Sex, which is being released on DVD in Australia. And then a guy called Tony Ganane went over to the US, hired a whole bunch of porn stars and made a soft porn movie called Phantasm, and that was soon followed by a sequel called, surprisingly enough, Phantasm Comes Again. And then ultimately in 1979, this ended up with John Lemond's film Felicity, which was kind of like an Australian version of Emmanuel with the sexual blossoming of a young girl. So sex films were incredibly popular in Ausploitation. But there were the other streams of it as well. There were films like Night of Fear, which was basically a proto-splatter film in some ways, and The Inn of the Damned and Lady Stay Dead. There was quite an atmospheric and creepy film called Long Weekend, where a husband and wife go camping out in the bush for a holiday, and as they get angrier and start wreaking some destruction on the bush, the landscape and the environment seems to fight back at them. It's quite a scary and atmospheric film. And of course there's Patrick as well, the one about the comatose psychokinetic killer. I talked about that in an earlier podcast. And the Thirst, I've talked about that in an earlier podcast. There was a film called Snapshot. Alison's Birthday, which I haven't seen, but I've got it on my list to see. And Road Games, Richard Franklin's film Road Games, which starred Stacey Keach and Jamie Lee Curtis, about a serial killer who travels the road from Melbourne to Perth and kills hitchhikers along the way. There were, I can't forget this one, Razorback, about a giant bush pig. And I mean bush pig in the porcine sense, not an ugly girl. So Razorback, it was really funny. I've got a friend, Lewis Morley in Sydney, who worked on Razorback. He was a special effects guy, and he made some of the pig heads for Razorback. And I remember in the late 80s going to his house, and we walked through the front door, and one of the pig heads from Razorback was over his mantelpiece, hung on the wall. An enormous, twice life-size pig head with bristles and piggy little eyes and all sorts of things like that. Quite an atmospheric film. Russell Mulcahy was the director. He was the first film he directed. And, of course, he went on to do Highlander and things like that, and his career maybe hasn't panned out the way he wanted it to since then. Ausploitation is an incredibly rich source of films, and in particular, genre films that just ran with it for about 15 years, as a run of about 15 years, where any number of these films came out and were, to varying extents, popular, with the audience, there are a lot of obscure ones too that never even get a look in films like Not Quite Hollywood in the documentary. There's a film called The Big Hurt, which was made by Barry Peake, who owned the Valhalla Cinema in Melbourne at the time, and a little low-budget thriller about some people in a sex club set in a posh house who discover a drug which turns pain into pleasure. And, of course, a sleazy investigative journalist looks into that and gets involved in the goings-on with that. I remember seeing that one at the cinema in the 1980s, and I now, fortunately, managed to acquire a copy of it. It isn't out on DVD, so a lot of these films, and particularly obscure films, which people have trouble finding good quality source material, end up being available only on BitTorrents and things like that. I'm a bit reluctant to go over too much more of it because a lot of this stuff is covered in the documentary Not Quite Hollywood. Of course, there's films like Mad Max, which is one of the classic... Mad Max basically is a Western with cars in it. But one of the things I particularly like about Mad Max, and it's not Mel Gibson, by the way, it's the fact that they filmed a lot of it about 5 kilometres where I'm sitting right now. The back roads between Melbourne and Geelong were where a lot of those really cool car smashes and bike crashes and ripping along the highway scenes were filmed. So every now and then we'll go for a drive and we'll go across a lot of the same roads you'll see if you look at the original Mad Max, those low rolling hills with a couple of higher hills in the background. There are a range of hills north of Geelong called the Yuyangs. And if I sit on the roof of my house, I can look at the Yuyangs from here. So I kind of I've got an increasing fondness for Mad Max because of the fact of the geographic proximity. And, of course, it went on to generate the 2 sequels. It became incredibly internationally popular once they dubbed American voices over the original Australian voices for reasons best known only to certain American movie producers in the early 1980s. But what I wanted to do before I finish up the podcast is talk about some of the more recent films which could be considered Ausploitation. There's a movie called Acolytes, which stars Joel Edgerton. It's a film made a couple of years ago in Brisbane. It's about a bunch of teenagers who are kind of getting a bit in trouble with the cops, who find a serial killer and get into the viewfinder of a serial killer. Small budget film set in a slightly unusual area around Brisbane, and it is quite scary and atmospheric. It's got a little bit of the Wolf Creek thing without being as full on over the top as Wolf Creek, which of course in itself is probably the biggest, most recent example of an Ausploitation movie. If you haven't seen Wolf Creek, it's about a serial killer in the outback, and it stars John Jarrett, one of Australia's classical actors, and very, very atmospheric, very creepy, and probably one of the most hardcore exploitation movies ever made in this country. There's also another one, a zombie film, which peaked just before the latest zombie craze, called Undead, which was made by the Sperry brothers up in Brisbane for a budget of about $1 million. I went to one of the sessions of this at the cinema where the Sperry brothers did a Q&A session, and it turns out that all the special effects in the film were done on a laptop computer. But great zombie film, a lot different than the normal one. Again, like a lot of small-budget Australian exploitation films, it has the feel of a Western to it. And definitely recommend that you see that one. The Sperry brothers have got a new film, a vampire film coming out called Daywalkers or something like that. I forget exactly the name of it, but look forward to seeing that one too. They got their finger on the pulse of the genre, and I think they're going to be quite big internationally in the exploitation area of cinema. And again, you know, really good fun zombie movie with a nice twist to it. It owes a little bit to some of Peter Jackson's early films, but I don't think it suffers because of that. So there are a number of genre films now being released. There's a rogue crocodile movie called Rogue, which was made by the same people who made Wolf Creek, and that is worth picking up on DVD. It should be available in the States and in other places. They use a combination of live crocodiles and, of course, animatronics and a bit of CG there, but it's all seamlessly put together, and there's quite an atmospheric ending to it as well, and a sense of realism, which is missing from a lot of other exploitation movies. So I don't have too much else to say about Ozploitation, except check out Not Quite Hollywood. It'll give you a good overview of Ozploitation movies. But if you hear of an Australian film coming out in your area on DVD or anything like that, check them out. If an Australian film gets an international release, even on DVD, because there's a local filtering process, and a lot of things won't be released overseas if they're not that much good. You guys, in a sense, get the best of what we have in other countries, and that it's worth dipping into. It's really interesting. I mean, for me, I lived through a lot of the Ozploitation things, but I'm still finding films that I haven't seen before from the 70s and the 80s, and even in the 1950s and 40s, there were some Australian films released. There's a big gap between the late 50s and about 1970, where there wasn't very much produced until Ted Kotcheff, a Canadian director, came over and produced a film called Wake in Fright, which has only just been reassembled from source material and re-released on DVD in Australia. Very frightening and borderline exploitation film. It's almost surrealistic in some aspects of it, but it's worth seeing. And I like the fact that the DVD revolution is allowing us to recapture cinema history. In America, cinema history tends to look after itself. There are incredibly large corporations who own the rights to these things and who protect and preserve a lot of the history of film in that country in particular. And the UK, the BFI in the UK, is doing a lot of the same work in some ways. But locally, it's a very much a catch-as-catch-can situation, where preserving the films is being done by companies that release DVDs, not necessarily big producers, but big distributors. Not even big ones. I mean, I've seen the headquarters of Umbrella Entertainment, and it's only a fairly small factory. And they are preserving and releasing a lot of good Australian material at the moment. So I think if you go to umbrellaentertainment.com.au or Mad Men Entertainment, if you Google those two search terms, you'll be able to find a lot of Australian films to buy. They will sell them to people overseas from the distributor themselves. And just as a final thing, I will say that I do have an enormous fondness for these films, particularly the classic ones, because they occurred at a time when I was growing up and just learning about cinema and learning about life, and I was independent for the first time. I gained independence slightly earlier than a lot of other people. I was wandering around Sydney at random at the age of 14, and it was a time when that wasn't perhaps as dangerous as it is now. And I was seeing a lot of movies because they were cheap to get into, and they were an entertainment, and they were an escape from what I had where I was living at the time at home. In a sense, I'm touching base with an earlier part of my history by seeing a lot of these films. It brings up memories, and they're not bad memories at all. A lot of my fondest memories are being in the cinema, watching a film in a darkened cinema, and just being taken somewhere else. And I think Ozploitation movies, particularly I suppose for people overseas, would be doing that. They take you somewhere else, and they show you a crazy imagined universe of car crashes and tits and ass and horror and exploitation in foreign landscapes for you. So definitely recommend it. Nothing else to say at this stage. I'm going to be doing something else totally different next time around. So in the meantime, you know the contact details. Drop me a line, let me know what you think. And I'll just leave you with a few little bits and pieces of audio from various Ozploitation films. And take care of yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. Till next time we meet cybernetically. Bye.
East meets West in a head-on clash with no holds barred. Golden Harvest, who made Bruce Lee a box office smash, have joined with Australia's action specialists to produce a death-defying spectacle that staggers the senses. The man from Hong Kong knows no rules. everyone he runs across is never quite the same again.
I understand the gunman is dead. How did that happen?
I killed him.
Really? Well, in that case, you deserve a cigar.
Why don't you get yourself a girlfriend, Tony?
Bollocky. Hazel Phillips as Peggy, rejecting suburbia for excitement in The Set.
Oh, God, you are beautiful. Big, brown, beautiful.
That was great.
Great? You must be joking.
Fuck me, dear.